You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, March 10th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ari Berman, writer for The Nation magazine, author extraordinaire, just having returned from Selma, Alabama, for the 50-year anniversary of Bloody Sunday. Also on the program today, as predicted, I think we predicted this like literally seconds after the story about Menendez came out, that there were potential charges against him for pay-to-play, I guess, corruption, that it would be immediately pounced upon by the right wing as some type of Iran conspiracy. Meanwhile, reverberations on that letter sent by 47 Republican senators to, I guess, their counterparts, the really far right wing conservative warmongering elements of the Iranian regime. That's what they do. They get together in like some type of leathered smoking room or something, or where they have cocktails. What are those?
The Iranians probably
social clubs.
The Iranians probably wouldn't have cocktails, to be
right. Well, I mean, you know, coffee,
Likud, neocons, and Iranian hardliners.
Right. And you'll never believe what the Daily News called them: traitors.
That blew my mind.
Yes, indeed. Also on the program today, a medical marijuana bill introduced in the Senate. Donna Edwards makes it official. She's in the race for the Senate. Also on the program, that frat at University of Oklahoma looks like they won't be having parties much longer. They're closed already. They had their Greek letters stripped from their house.
Fast.
Very quickly. The Missouri Supreme Court takes over the Ferguson Municipal Courts. And just a wonderful, I guess, coda to this from Fox News, where they tell us that, you know, every company has racist emails going around. And really, the Department of Justice basically said nothing much going on there but what normally happens in most towns. So we will get to that sound. Folks, reminder, podcast awards, we need your vote. Head over there. Vote for us at podcastawards.com for best podcast in politics and news. We need your support. You can vote every day. Also, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. People say, like, why do you say that every day? But, you know, the fact of the matter is, if I don't remind people that we still want them to become members, they tend to forget. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ari Berman of The Nation. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the program one of my favorite guests, one of the one of, I believe, one of the premier experts on voting rights and the Voting Rights Act in this country. His book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, will be published in early August. You can pre-order now. We'll put a link to that on the site. And he has just returned from Selma, Alabama, to celebrate, or I guess to cover the remembrance of the 50-year anniversary of Bloody Sunday. Ari Berman, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Thank you very much for having me.
You had a piece in The Nation anticipating your visit down to Selma. 50 years after Bloody Sunday in Selma, everything and nothing has changed. And I got to say, I was shocked to see how much nothing had changed. I mean, that part of it. But before we get to that, you know, for those people who don't know the history of Selma or have – I guess haven't seen the movie or haven't been up on how Selma was so instrumental in the struggle for voting rights and how it was implemented so quickly there and the implications of that. Just give us a brief roundup.
Sure. Well, I mean, you have to go back a little bit. I mean, Selma's always been disproportionately influential, both in the politics of Alabama and just in the politics of the U.S. as well, because it was once one of the biggest cities in Alabama because it was a center, first, of the slave trade, and because of its rich soil, it also was a center of the cotton trade. So that made it very powerful in antebellum Alabama. And then there were a huge battle during the Civil War. Union troops burned Selma to the ground, and so there was a lot of resentment after the Civil War, and Selma was instrumental in disenfranchising black voters through things like literacy tests and poll taxes, and basically became one of the most segregationist cities in Alabama. It wasn't as well known as, for example, a Birmingham, but it was the headquarters of the White Citizens Council, which was kind of like the white-collar Klan in Alabama. And basically, it became one of the most segregated cities in all of the South, if not the most segregated city in the South. And so in the 1960s, you had a situation where there was basically only about 2% of African Americans in Selma, were registered to vote, and there had been efforts for a long time in Selma by local residents to try to register black voters, but it had never really been possible because segregation was maintained with such an iron grip there. And so Martin Luther King chose Selma as the place where he wanted to lead the voting rights effort because Selma was so segregated, because there was already a movement there, and because there was a crazy sheriff named Jim Clark who he knew would provoke national attention by mistreating the demonstrators. Now, people, I don't think, even knew the extent of the mistreatment, because, of course, on the Bloody Sunday March, people like John Lewis nearly died. And that, of course, is what was celebrated over the weekend. So Selma has really been a pivotal city in the civil rights struggle for a very long time.
And tell us who some of the people who were, I guess, celebrating the Frederick Douglass Reese. Who's he?
Frederick Douglass Reese was the chairman or the president of the Dallas County Voters League in 1964, 1965. And the Dallas County Voters League was basically the main voting rights group in Selma. There was a number of black professionals in Selma, people like Fred Reese, people like Amelia Boynton, the 103-year-old woman who marched next to Barack Obama on Saturday. And so they invited King to Selma because they knew that they needed the national leadership of the civil rights movement to be able to take it to another level. And Reese is a fascinating guy because not only was he instrumental in the civil rights struggle in 1965, but later on, you know, he became the first black city council member in Selma in 1972. He was superintendent of the schools. He ran for mayor in 1984. He was the first serious black candidate to ever run for mayor in Selma. His campaign manager later became the first black mayor in Selma. So he's one of these unsung foot soldiers of the movement that has really played an instrumental role in Selma for over 50 years.
And so, and you write in your piece that after the passage of the voting rights, and we should say that I imagine Martin Luther King received a lot of invitations to come on behalf of voting rights all around the country, and they ended up deciding Selma was the best place strategically to go. But the and after the Voting Rights Act was passed, Selma was the first place in the country DOJ, I guess, registrars went. Is that right?
Yeah, so the Department of Justice initially picked nine counties, basically the nine counties with the worst record on voting rights, to send federal officials in the South to register black voters and white voters, but it was primarily black voters that registered after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And so the first black voter was registered in Selma. And I talk a lot about how this whole process worked in my book. I mean, it's really fascinating, the idea that you had a place where there were fewer than 300 black voters for almost 100 years, and then, you know, in one weekend, far more than that are registered. It's a really fascinating, pivotal moment in our history, that those few days after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and just tracing how black political power and how American politics more broadly was able to change after that. And so Selma was really the headquarters. The federal government knew that they had to get it right in Selma because Selma was the headquarters of the civil rights struggle, and it was so symbolic of the problems all across the country.
And the implications in terms of political power, despite the fact that the mayor was still – the mayor lasted apparently, what, like 30 years, right?
35 years.
Talk about how – I mean, that blew me away. Among other sort of institutions, I guess, that have remained in Selma for an extended period of time, long past what one would imagine their due date was.
So one of the things I talk about in the piece is that Selma is not Ferguson in the sense that right now there are black elected officials across Selma, whereas in Ferguson there are virtually none, even though there's significant black populations in both cities. But it's not like it happened overnight. The fights to democratize Selma have been going on for essentially five decades since the passage of the Voting Rights Act. You didn't get the first black city council member until 1972, 7 years after the Voting Rights Act, and that was a result of a threatened federal lawsuit under the Voting Rights Act. The first county commissioners and the first black county commissioners in the area weren't elected until 1989, 24 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, after a voting rights suit that took 10 years to decide. As you mentioned, the first black mayor wasn't elected until 2000, which is staggering, because the white mayor, who was the same mayor that was there in 1964, at a time he was a major segregationist, he basically held on to power through a very powerful patronage machine. And so one of the things I show in the piece is that just how long it took to get these changes, how much resistance there was to the Voting Rights Act, even in Selma, which was the poster child for the VRA. And that just goes to show you how hard it's been all across the country to make these changes.
And then on top of that, on top of that sort of dynamic, how slow, I guess, the sort of the electoral and strictly political changes took place. The economic and I guess really just the economic and some institutional changes have yet to really even take place. You wrote, blacks now control Selma politically, but longstanding racial disparities persist. The West Side, where most whites live, has tall pines, manicured lawns, and the city's only country club, which remains all white. What?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of institutional racism still in Alabama and still in Selma, and there's a lot of, I don't know if I would call this institutional racism, but certainly social segregation that goes on. The only country club, Selma is not the nicest place in America. I'm just going to say that and put it mildly. So the fact that they have a country club is sort of remarkable. And the fact that the country club is still segregated is even more remarkable. You think people there would be a little bit more sensitive to this issue, given how everything that has gone on.
Is it officially segregated? In other words, can you not get in if you're a black
person?
No.
But I mean, that's the thing is, it's not officially segregated. It's not written into, as far as I'm concerned, the constitution of the country club that it's segregated. The issue is that two members of the country club can essentially veto any new members.
Uh-huh.
And there, so it's like de facto, because there's at least two people that are just, they've basically said they're never going to admit a black person. And so even if there are more forward-thinking members of the country club, and I'm sure there are, because there are judges and people like that that are members, that by all accounts are not racist, but they still belong to this, what is essentially still a racist institution.
And they're you've got things like the memorial to General Nathan Bedford Forrest. That's nice. Who's he?
So Nathan Bedford Forrest was the first Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, and he's from Selma. He was a notoriously racist Confederate general. He might be one of the most racist Confederate generals ever. And as a resident of Selma, he's basically celebrated in Confederate history circles. There's an extremely provocative memorial to him in the town's Confederate cemetery that calls him one of the heroes of the South, and that has inflamed a lot of tensions.
To be fair, Ari, right? I mean, he's the first Grand Wizard, so he's sort of like an innovator. He was like a disruptor.
Yes. He was a trailblazer when it came to...
I mean, this stuff blows me away. I mean, itself.
I think some of this stuff is symbolic, but I think some of it is very real. And to me, the most disturbing things were, number one, the fact that the schools are almost totally segregated still, which affects everything in Selma. It affects the fact that people are moving away. It affects the fact that people don't want to move back, that there's no opportunities for higher advancement. And it had essentially the last integrated school system in the whole region in the 70s and 80s, but in the 90s, as a result of basically the first black school superintendent in Selma was fired by the city council, which was extremely stupid. And there was protests and the schools resegregated afterwards. So I think that's very unfortunate. The second thing that I found extremely disturbing is that Alabama taxes basically like large farms and agricultural and timber land way, way, way below market value, at 10% of the market value. What that means is that the biggest industries in the area pay no taxes. So the town has no money and the schools have no money. And the reason this was done was basically because after the civil rights movement, wealthy white landowners didn't want to pay any money to fund integrated or predominantly black schools. And that's a huge issue in Alabama that no one really talks about. And it basically makes it so that Selma and so many towns like it are going to be perpetually broke and underfunded.
People should understand how explicit this is, because we all know the dynamic that one of the problems we have with education, broadly speaking, in this country is that it is financed by property taxes. And so if you have a major portion of your property which is basically walled off from taxes. If you lived in a town that was sort of every piece of property was owned by a church, you'd have a real problem funding education. In this instance, these are not churches. They're just white-owned, wealthy industrialist businesses that did not want their money redistributed to black kids basically going to school. That's basically it in a nutshell. And all of this is just sort of like is stunning. Even when you go back, I mean, to the political stuff back in 96, as late as 96, that Dallas County Sheriff race, who's the same, he's the one, right? I mean, he was the Jim Clark and was still trying to steal an election in the 90s.
No, it was 1966.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jeez. Okay.
It was the first election after the Voting Rights Act that he tried to steal.
Oh, sorry.
He was prevented from doing so because of the Voting Rights Act. But, and that became a fascinating symbol of what the power of the VRA would be and how it was going to be difficult to subvert it. And you had to be more creative, basically. You couldn't just outright steal elections anymore, but you had to be more creative in terms of making it harder to vote and making it harder to win elections. And people in Selma were more creative, and that's why it took so long to democratize the area.
Yeah, I think I got confused between him and Joe Smitherman.
There's a lot of dates in the article. Don't worry, Sam.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. But what happens now? Tell the story of those folks who moved down. There was a bunch of people who moved from, was it Colorado?
Yeah.
This is stunning to me. It's just the idea, you know, we have this notion of, well, they're making movies about this place. It's like it's almost like a big museum to America's forward thinking. And, you know, you would imagine that place would be sort of sacrosanct, like where, you know, if I was a huge bigot, racial bigot, I wouldn't necessarily want to stay in that town because of its symbolism, or at least the way that we perceive it, I think, in the rest of the country. But this story of those folks who came down from Colorado, tell that part.
Yeah, so 60 people moved from Denver to Selma in 2007, 2008 after visiting on a civil rights pilgrimage. And they were doing social justice work, and they decided they would have more impact in a small town like Selma than a big city like Denver. And one couple, they had a girl who was 4 at the time, and it was too late for her to go to the public preschool. So she was sent to private preschool, and most of her friends at the private preschool were white. She was black. And she decided that when she was in kindergarten, she wanted to go to this place called the Morgan Academy. The Morgan Academy was founded in 1965, 3 months after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, 3 months after Bloody Sunday, I should say, by conservative white parents who basically didn't want their kids going to integrated schools. It was named after John Morgan, an Alabama senator who was the first Grand Dragon, a Grand Wizard of the Alabama Clan. There's so many people in Selma that were members of the Klan or former Grand Dragons. It's hard to keep track. But anyway, this school was totally segregated, and they decided that in 2008 they were going to apply for their daughter. And she was accepted, which reflected some forward thinking. But it was a very rough process for her when she got to school. She was not bullied. but friends of hers who had older siblings were bullied, and there she wasn't allowed, for example, to go over to her white friend's house for birthday parties or for sleepovers. They wouldn't go to her birthday parties or sleepovers. And I think most disturbingly, on the back of the local Walmart, there was graffiti of her being lynched, which I think was really, really
2008.
Shocking. 2008.
You're right.
She was then pulled out of the school after 2 years.
You write that when their daughter was first admitted, they were told to expect 25 people at the first parents' meeting. 500 showed up at the school's gym and were complaining that their heritage was being ruined because this 5-year-old girl had been admitted. I mean, this is 2008. I mean, it's – now, let me ask you this. In Selma, are there wealthier black families that are living on that west side, or is it just like that's a racial divide, not even an economic class divide?
So there's an integrated neighborhood near downtown where most of the old mansions are, and that area is more integrated now simply because so many white families have left, and so you can get like these incredible mansions for a few $100,000, and that's allowed the black upper middle class and the black upper class in Selma, to the extent that it exists, to buy some of those homes. So for example, like the district attorney and people like that, they're able to afford some of these mansions. So there is a kind of integrated pocket in downtown. But my understanding is the west side is still basically all white and the east side is basically all black. And there is some intermingling in terms of, you know, government functions in that. But as I mentioned, the schools are still segregated. Mm. The country club is still segregated. And so the main institutions in the town are still segregated.
And civil rights workers who moved from Colorado, many of them left, didn't they?
Some of them had to leave, yeah. Some of them are still there, and they are integrated. I mean, there are interracial couples, and the church there is very integrated. And so that perhaps gives people hope. But when I started asking them, well, you know, where do these kids go to school? They still don't go to school together. Right. The white children are still going to the private school, and most of the black children are still going to public school.
And lastly, I mean, give me a sense of what you saw when you were down there. I mean, was there anything that I imagine that was not your first time down there, but was the town on its best behavior? Or, I mean, how is it different when they were celebrating this than when you would visit in the past?
Well, I mean, I went there twice in the last few weeks. I went there to report this story, which I was there over President's Day weekend. And, I mean, they were in the process, I think, of trying to beautify the town. But, I mean, there's nearly as many vacant stores downtown as there are occupied ones. And you just can't beautify that. I mean, I heard when Oprah went to town, they were putting signs in the window to make it seem like vacant buildings were occupied. Mm. But basically,
when Oprah went to town,
when Oprah was there, yeah,
well,
they were
course,
trying to
really
make
good.
It look. They're trying to make it look more happening than it was. But I mean, they were fixing it up a little bit, but I mean, it was still like pretty dilapidated. And then when I went there again this weekend for the 50th anniversary, I mean, you're basically just, going to the bridge and going to Brown Chapel. You're not really walking around much. There are houses around the churches that are still in disrepair. And theoretically people saw that, but there was also a lot going on this weekend. And mm-hmm. So my whole point was, if you want to understand Selma today and any of these towns today, you got to get beyond the bridge. You have to get beyond the main attractions, and you have to look around a little bit. And if you look around a little bit, you realize that a lot of things have not changed.
Ari Berman, thanks for taking the time. I know you're on deadline. You've got to finish that book, Ari. We've already got people who are pre-ordering it at our site at majority.fm. Give us the ballot, the modern struggle for voting rights in America. We will have you on again, of course, to talk about the book, and you will update us periodically on the complete impossibility of anticipating the Republicans who control Congress to pass a fix for the Voting Rights Act since the Supreme Court did their best to gut it.
Yeah, and I have a new piece about that in the nation. When I was in Selma, I talked to a number of Republicans, including a bunch of Republican senators, and I asked them about the Voting Rights Act, and they expressed an openness on the issue, so which I guess is about as much progress as you can expect.
In other words, they didn't say, shut up, we're not going to do that? I mean,
well, some of them did, but I mean, at least they kept their – all options are on the table, I guess you could say.
Was it –
which is considered – which is what counts for progress nowadays.
There were reports that much of the Republican leadership was too busy to go. Was that the case, or was there decent representation from Republicans there?
Well, I mean, there was about 20-something Republicans there. The majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, decided to come like super last minute. Mm. I mean, this trip was in the works for months.
Well, but Ari, people couldn't anticipate that this would happen, that it would be 50 years.
So, I mean, there really was no excuse not for Speaker Boehner or for Leader McConnell not to clear their schedule. I mean, it was pretty blatant that they decided not to. I don't know what they were doing. The 2016 candidates at least were at some event in Iowa. I don't know what Boehner and McConnell were doing, but there really was no excuse for them to miss it. They had a lot of advance warning. They knew it was happening. Eric Cantor had been there the last 2 years. And so I think it was very telling that even though they had the largest turnout ever for Republicans, there were still only 23 that went, and McCarthy decided to get on basically the last flight to Birmingham to make it down there.
It's stunning, stunningly telling. I mean, it's just amazing that, you know, because they just must think that, like, we just can't afford to expend the political cachet to go down there and celebrate this event that's 50 years ago.
I mean, I think that the issue has become so politicized that I think they believe that actually even going to Selma, not even doing anything, but simply going to Selma will inflame their base. That rather that instead of the town being a symbol of progress or even a symbol of history that we should acknowledge and celebrate and remember, it's a symbol that they are doing some crazy subversive work and somehow overthrowing the values of freedom and small government the Tea Party claims to stand for. So I don't know how we got to this place where even visiting Selma is controversial, but somehow to some people it evidently was.
All right, Berman, always a pleasure. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Sam. Bye.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, I don't even understand, like, how, you know, I guess it's just, let me put it this way. It's really important to understand if you want to get a sense of just how craven politicians in general are. And you want to get a sense of just how deeply embedded the racism in the Republican Party has to be. I mean, I know that it's sort of facile and you could throw it away. And, you know, they're racists. And that doesn't mean that all Republicans are racist. It doesn't even mean the majority of Republicans are racist. It does mean that there's a substantial, at the very least, a substantial minority of Republicans. You know, we're talking like at the very least 30 or 40% that would prevent you as the Speaker of the House, ostensibly not. You're not the Republican speaker. You are the Speaker of the House, who is also a Republican. But nevertheless, you're the one of the majority leaders of the two parties in this country. And it is politically toxic for you to go and simply visit Selma, Alabama. Contemplate that for a moment. Just even visiting Selma, which is renowned simply because it was the birthplace of, or not even the birthplace, it was integral in making sure that black people had the right to vote. Going there is toxic for you. Now, it's one thing to say, like, it's toxic for Steve Scalise because, you know, this is a guy who, you know, he would go and give talks to racist organizations, and that was sort of like where, you know, some of his political base was from. But ostensibly, Mitch McConnell coming from Kentucky and John Boehner coming from Ohio, it wouldn't be so controversial to at the very least even pay lip service to Selma. But for them, it is incredibly toxic. And what's amazing to me is how, if you are one of those guys, do you look in the mirror and say, like, I'm proud of what I do for a living. I'm proud of myself. I'm proud of the party that I am a leader of. And I go like, wow, I can't even go to Selma without it being a liability. I mean, that just seems to me to be, I mean, if you wanted to know a reason why Bonaire hits the bottle occasionally, that seems to be a good reason to me to do it.
I think two just quick follow-ups on that. One, you would think, again, with Scalise, because he didn't lose his job. If the Republican Party was not so far in this direction, this would be the obvious, like, you know what? Let's get some good photo ops down there, because that guy kept his job after addressing racist groups and saying he was like David Duke.
So they can't even do, use it as damage
they
control.
They cannot even do it for optics.
Right.
That's a really important point. And then number two, it's like, yeah, I agree with you that you know, 60% of Republicans are not personally racist or whatever, but you have to feel such a high comfort level around that so that even if you are personally not, it's like, it's not the biggest deal in the world to oppose voting rights. It's not the biggest deal in the world to – hey, people have different views of Bloody Sunday. Some people thought it was a march forward. Other people thought it was an assault on their traditions. Who am I to judge, man?
Right.
Let me max out a pharma check for my next campaign.
I don't know. It's also like those people who are in the country club there. Like, I'm not personally racist, and I would have absolutely no problem – in fact, in a bad situation, as I hate to, one of the characters there, considered herself to be taking down. I think we did an interview with, Janine was playing a sort of, someone who perceived herself as being sort of fighting for racial justice. And the reason why she maintained her membership in the all-white country club was to tear it down from the inside. She said in an interview. I mean, that. So that.
I'm
going to.
I'm biding my time here. Let me just tee up another hole.
Exactly.
I've been here for over 30 years, but at some point.
My strategy to tear down this country club from the inside is to order only. Those alcoholic beverages that I understand they're not getting the proper amount of markup on. You see, normally when one drinks a mint julep, the markup is close to 70%. I've done my calculations, 65%. If I drink enough of these at the country club, perhaps it will weaken the foundations.
As Malcolm X himself once said, by any means necessary.
That's right.
I'll have another mint julep, please.
That's right.
And just to reiterate,
I may find it necessary to tee off today. I'm decided I'm going to slow walk the front nine as a protest. So all of you behind me who have to wait for me to slow walk my way to the ball, perhaps maybe next time you should ask yourself, why is everything not integrated here?
This place needs to be more like an Arnold Palmer. You know the drink?
Mm. I was just thinking, as the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King said, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. And I ponder that as I slow walk on the green.
The arc of history is long, but it shanks a little bit to the left into the rough.
I was actually thinking, too, of, like, the two people that you need to object. Like, you know, that he said that. So, like, they're all just like, maybe you want to be the two this month that just randomly doesn't has a problem with the black family joining.
We don't want to rush anything here.
Because I personally, you know, like, I know last month I objected to that other black family, but I got no problem with these black family this month, personally.
I'm not in charge of the membership this week, this month.
It's so odd the way we can't all just agree, but, you know, judge a man by the content of his character, not the color of his skin. I make myself laugh every time I say that.
All right. All right, let's go to the – oh.
Taxes for black kids, no. Right, exactly. I can't even be ironic about that.
That's where it persists. It reminded me of South Africa so much listening to it.
Unbelievable.
I mean, it was kind of mind-blowing, the analogies there of like just even like getting some change in political leadership that's had very little effect on economic and institutional transition.
I mean, largely, you know, because things like property taxes and whatnot are outside the purview of that. And what was interesting, too, is that, you know, in some of those lawsuits that actually brought about the election of African-Americans to the city council, that was a function of – and this was a standard practice in – I guess it was – and I think it may have been a function of the progressive movement, although I'm not 100% sure of that. But there was a good government movement. Back in the, I guess it was in the 20s, where you would see this at large voting for city council members. And it was a function of basically getting the big money to win all the elections in the towns. I know this just from like studying Worcester politics, and that's what has the effect. If you're running in a citywide election, obviously the money is going to win. And by going to a system where there is some direct representation for districts in a town, obviously you get more you get people who live in every district in the city, and therefore you are more apt to get a more representational city council, one that represents the city more accurately. And so you've gotten, at least in the context of Selma, more black elected officials, but they don't necessarily have the ability to change things like property taxes because that seems to be set up on a county level. So
that just underlines that those transitions and reforms never happened because, as you say, the black politicians had no power over these larger policies if they ran the city, and because of money. And then not only would none of that happen, now we're just going to march back as far as voting rights, as far as like the actual infrastructure of civil rights law.
Right.
It's and I kept thinking the whole time of Rush Limbaugh going, Selma, like mocking it.
Yeah.
It's just disgusting.
Speaking of Rush Limbaugh, in the better half of the program today, it is an anniversary for Rush Limbaugh today. It has been 5 years. We'll tell you more in the better half. Folks, don't forget to vote, please. Podcastawards.com literally takes you seconds to vote. It is linked at majority.fm, but you can go to podcastawards.com. Vote for us in Best Politics. Also, don't forget to vote for Best of the Left for People's Choice. The more popular they become and they play our show, the more popular that we become, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Also, don't forget to become a member.
Real quick on Podcast Awards, sometimes you'll get sent a verification email, as we've mentioned, and some people have been saying that verification email goes to their spam. So check spam for the verification.
And you've got to click on the link. And I think if you do that a couple of times, they don't ask you to do that. But you can vote every day, and it's really important that you do, because those evil forces fighting us for the Podcast Awards are. It closes on March 24th. So every day that you miss is a vote that someone else has garnered. Even Bush in chains is voting, folks. And he hates the vote. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. MajorityReportKickback.com. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. Go to MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap from there. We get a kickback. Thus, MajorityReportKickback.com. The number, 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me through the app, which you can get for free at MajorityApp.com. Or you can IM me through AOL Instant Messaging. Be back in a sec. I can't.
She says you're only okay to me. Only a brother to me. She's a say no, 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 no. She'll say no.